the housing crisis is across the board. It's hard for us to go into an office tower. I should say it's rare for us to go into an office where a member says, I don't have a housing crisis in my district. It's everywhere, as we know. So we know it needs to get addressed.
Welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the partner in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Gary Gibson, a partner at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. Today, our guest in the Buzz House is our good friend, friend of the industry, and well-known industry advocate, David Gasson, who is representing the Housing Advisory Group. David, thanks so much for joining us again today.
It is a pleasure to be with you guys, as always.
Of course, the Housing Advisory Group's mission is to educate members of Congress, senators, their staffs, and administration officials on the value of the low-income housing tax credit and other affordable housing programs. Today, we're very excited to talk with David on a variety of topics. What is going on in D.C. surrounding the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, which of course has been around for a few years, new Biden-Harris administration housing supply action plan, HUD budget items, discussion around insurance, which I know is on the top of many of your minds. And again, we're going to end with how to get involved with supporting the aforementioned items. Without further ado, we're going to jump into it. I'm going to turn over to Garrick, and we'll start the discussion. Garrick?
Thanks, Don, for that intro, and thanks, David, for being back on the Buzz House. Before we jump in with some questions, why don't you give our listeners some insight into your background and work with the Housing Advisory Group?
Great. I'm happy to. For those in the industry or anybody else listening who are not tired of seeing or listening to me as I travel the country, preaching the gospel of affordable housing. So my career started in Washington way back in 1985. I worked on Capitol Hill for 10 years. I initially worked for the House Democratic leader, Dick Gephardt of Missouri, and then was fortunate to then get to work for the Senate Majority Leader, George Mitchell from Maine. So it was an amazing time. It was a very different time in Washington. Everything back then was different. Washington has never been perfect, and it has never been as bad as it was. But the level of bipartisanship and the mission that most members of the House and the Senate, no matter what their affiliation was to work on behalf of their constituents and get stuff done, more so than to blame people for what was happening or not getting done. So I am very appreciative that I got to work in Washington when I did. Following my tenure in D.C., I worked for 25 years at Boston Capital, a former syndication firm in the business. And as soon as I started at BC, I started running and then putting together the Housing Advisory Group. So we've been around for quite some time, since 1993, to be specific, founded by Herb Collins, one of the founders of the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, and just have gotten to know and learn so much more about housing than I ever thought I would and become a passionate advocate of it. The Housing Advisory Group has about 150 or so members from around the country. We are largely, and we're founded this way, as a developer-based advocacy group. So you have a number of industry groups within the industry that focus on different parts of the industry. We were founded to complement other groups in the industry and give a developer's perspective, because what the founders were seeing, both of this, the Affordable Housing Tax Credit Coalition, and some of the other groups, is that senators and congressmen related differently to different people. So some of them wanted to hear from experts, practitioners, accountants, attorneys, investors. Some of them thought they were the boogeymen, and they want to hear from the folks who live in their district and are working on their issues, and those were the developers. And that was the basis for founding the Housing Advisory Group, to give and advocate for the developer's perspective. So we've been around for quite some time now. We love what we do. We are passionate about advocacy and love anybody else who's interested to come on board and join us in this. It's not a fight, it's a quest, it's a mission.
Love it. Thank you for that, David. David, kind of jumping right into questions, I know this has been around a couple of years. The last time you were with us on the Buzz House, we discussed the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act. Not passed yet, and maybe we'll have a follow-up question on timing, maybe gaining some traction. Can you again maybe remind our listeners some key components in that draft legislation?
Sure. We are very psyched and happy with how the AHCIA is doing in the context of support in D.C. The provisions, Don, a lot of the key, they change over time because we've been successful. As I like to tell folks when I speak, the nice thing about working on behalf of low-income housing tax credit and being in this industry is that in D.C., we win. I mean, over the course of the program, since it was founded in 86 and then put into action in 87, we've consistently expanded the program, gotten regulatory relief for the program, worked on building more housing, but we're able to do that because as we educate lawmakers and their staffs, they see the potential and the benefits of the program. So LIHTC wins. I know it's hard to see or feel sometimes, but we do. So this latest version that we're working on now, the main focus is obviously on the 9% side, regaining the allocation which we lost when that expired a year ago. So getting back the 12.5% in allocation that we got back in 2018, and then expanding on that, getting an increase, a bump in the 9% allocation. The second most important thing is on the bond side, the bond program, and that's a reduction of the 50% test. We have successfully demonstrated to Congress, but more importantly, I would say the Joint Committee on Taxation, that the 50% test was arbitrary. It's not 50 for any reason. At one point, it was 70. We wanted to come down below 50. But we have a lot of support for that now, and they see the potential that would bring to the marketplace if we could reduce that in more bond capacity. So we feel confident about that. Now, we'll talk about what might get done, but when that gets done, it might not go down to 25. It might go down to 30. It might go to 35. But any reduction in the 50% test would be significant. And then we have a number of basis boosts that we feel very strongly about. Obviously, the one, the basis boost for bond deals, which currently does not exist. Basis boost for rural areas. We are particularly keen on that because the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Jason Smith, is from one of the most rural districts in the country in Missouri. And this definitely resonates with him. He likes affordable housing. He loves LIHTC. He's a former co-sponsor of the AHCIA. We are fortunate to have a Republican chairman again that supports the program, but he is singularly focused on increasing housing production in rural areas and what can be done to do that. The rural basis boost, reduction of the 50% test, 9%, they would all do this. And we've explained that to he and his staff, and they are supportive. And then there are myriad, I mean, Don and Garrick, there are, I think, 27 provisions in the AHCIA. We are very much focused on the resource provisions right now because that's what everybody needs. But that's kind of like what we think is going to be in play at the end of the year. As it gets really fun, the game of roll the dice, let's do a tax bill, and what can we get in there in the context of LIHTC?
David, thank you for that overview and right production. We know we need it. And getting on that point, at the end of the year, you just alluded to it. What is the progress? What is the tool? What is the methodology? What's the timing? What's that kind of look like? And I know it's a crystal ball kind of question.
Yeah. Well, every Congress is different, as we know. And for those who don't have to play in Congress, God bless you, although we hope you're still advocating for the program. But as little as you have to deal with the folks in D.C., maintain your sanity. Keep doing what you're doing and try not to focus too much on what goes on inside the Beltway. But every Congress is different. This one obviously has its interesting aspects to it, as we saw after the election and what they've done thus far. But as far as tax is concerned, we're in a very interesting situation because, as everyone knows, last year we passed an omnibus bill, but for the first time that many of us can remember, they did not include a tax title with the omnibus bill. They did do the Secure 2.0, which was the retirement, but they kind of walled that off and didn't let anything else tax attach itself to it. So they did an omnibus and no tax. And we were all sitting there thinking for sure we were going to get a reduction of the 50% test and the 12.5% of the 9 back. And then us and every other tax professional in the country or anybody with an issue was like, wait, what? I mean, you're leaving, that's it, you're done. And staff and a lot of members felt that way too. So that, you guys, coupled with the fact that next year is a presidential election cycle, and there has never that any of us can remember, I hate to say never, but as far as we can remember, there's never been a significant piece of tax legislation in a presidential election cycle. So if they do not do something at the end of this year, and they didn't do something last year, and we pretty much know they're not going to do anything next year, that is a huge gap in the context of tax policy at a time where so many tax provisions have expired, are in the process of expiring out. They're reducing their benefits, bonus depreciation being one of them, or they will expire. And 2025 is a big year, because many of the tax cuts in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the bill that President Trump passed, are going to expire on the individual side in 2025. So we know there's going to be a big tax bill in 2025. That's 2 years down the road before that might get done. So that would be 4 or 5 years since they will have done significant tax policy. And there's just so much on the table that needs to get done on a bipartisan basis. There are some things that Democrats and Republicans both believe in. LIHTC is one of them, thus our strong bipartisan support. And then there are things that one side wants versus maybe not as much as the other and vice versa, which they'll negotiate on. But there are other provisions and enough of them that we believe, even if they can't reach an agreement on the stuff they disagree on, child tax credit, bonus depreciation, R&D tax credit, which I don't buy because that's pretty bipartisan, but they play that as one versus the other. There are other provisions out there like LIHTC and a myriad of others that they do agree on that they could do a tax title and get rid of the ones that are bipartisan and off the table so that going into 2025, there's not this like overwhelming list of tax provisions that need to get addressed, which is going to be ridiculously expensive if they wait to do it all at once. Not even accounting for the fact of the effect it's going to have on the economy, on business and individuals if they don't start to take some of these off the table. And LIHTC being one of them on the production side. So we do feel like, and in talking to staff and members, we sense their optimism that there will be some kind of tax title at the end of the year. Now, there are a number of things they need to get done this year. We'll talk about the budget in a second, but they have yet to pass the Farm Bill, which expires on September 30th, ironically, same day as the budget. They haven't done FAA reauthorization, which expires on September 30th. They have to pass the National Defense Authorizing Act, which both chambers have passed a bill, but they don't sync up, so they have to negotiate that. Those are some pretty big nuts that if they do stopgap measures and they move to the end of the year, well, boom, there you have a big bill that they could attach then a tax title to and pass this big piece of significant legislation and then leave town knowing they got stuff done. As far as AHCIA is concerned, there is no tax provision that has had the level of support and as much bipartisan support as the AHCIA. As of today, you guys, we have 164 bipartisan co-sponsors for the AHCIA. It's more than we've ever had. We are only 54 co-sponsors away from the magic number of 218, which is a majority of the House. And we think we're going to get there. That's 27 more Republicans and 27 more Democrats. We feel confident we're going to get to 218, and it's hard for anybody in leadership to look at tax provisions and not look at one that has a majority of the House on a bipartisan basis and supporting it and not saying we have to that we're going to act on that when it includes some of those provisions. On the Senate side, we have 28 bipartisan co-sponsors in the Senate, which is, if not the most, close to the most we've ever had in the Senate. So the support's there for LIHTC. The housing crisis is across the board. It's hard for us to go into an office, or I should say it's rare for us to go into an office where a member says, I don't have a housing crisis in my district. It's everywhere, as we know. So we know it needs to get addressed. It's just a matter of getting Congress to move on it. But we're optimistic that we're going to get something done by the end of the year.
Well, optimism is a good thing. That kind of leads me to my discussion on the housing plans. I mean, there was actually a Biden-Harris administration housing supply action plan that was presented last year, basically to help close that housing supply gap in 5 years. And a lot of that gap comes from affordable housing. So we know it's important to this administration. And so hopefully something can get done this year at a minimum. So in that plan, what was that process to get this plan done? And how does that even fit in the overall housing policy importance to them?
Yeah, Garrick, I've been trying to think of a good analogy to talk about the administration's housing plan, because as you know, we largely focus on tax, the low-income housing tax credit, which was included in the president's housing plan. We will dabble in appropriations in the context where it fits in the HUD funding, RD, so on and so forth, as it affects LIHTC, or just if our members are really focused on one provision that is so significant. When we got done being able to use Section 8 in conjunction with LIHTC and things like that. But we don't really focus that much on the appropriations side. Other industry groups, that's their charge and they do that. The administration was a soup to nuts housing plan. They covered everything. They touched on appropriations, tax, zoning, infrastructure for housing, energy issues in the context of housing. They were like everything. And I will say this, and I mean it sincerely, and as I should have said earlier when we got started, but I'll go ahead and put the disclaimer out there now. Housing Advisory Group and all the allies we work with, we are nonpartisan. We're not bipartisan. We're nonpartisan. We don't care what party you represent, no party, any party. If you support housing, we're going to work with you to try to get stuff done. This administration has been one of the most open and energetic and enthusiastic in the context of working on housing policy that I know I've experienced in the 30 years that I've been in the business doing this. There have been past administrations that have been very helpful, but none that have focused on it to the degree that the Biden administration has, including putting people in place in this administration who are housers. And at every step of the process, whether it's in the National Economic Council, the Council of Economic Advisors, the Domestic Policy Council, OMB, we've already gotten tons of things done thanks to the housers at OMB. And then at the agencies, HUD. We have honest to God housers at HUD right now, from the secretary who knows it was a supporter, but from the deputy secretary, Adrian Todman, all the way down through the agency, are people not only that are housers, but that we all know. I mean, they're names that you and I and the three of us have been working with for years in the housing industry. And the administration said, no, we want to get people in there who know what they're talking about and can get stuff done. So I give them credit for that. We have regular meetings with folks within the White House and at HUD, and sometimes at the White House and at HUD, especially since the COVID restrictions have been lifted. And they've been incredibly productive at every step of the way. And not just in what we're talking about today, which is legislation and policy, but on the regulatory front, the things we've been able to get done by getting the White House to knock on the door and say, no, fix this, get this done. This is important. It's going to result in more housing. They've not been shy about doing that. So I can't speak enough about how well the administration's been a partner on the housing front. So this housing plan was great. They tried to do a lot of things. It was very obviously, just like the president's budget, aspirational. You know it's not all going to get done. But we got them to focus on some issues, specifically on the regulatory front, kind of give like a little nudge to their agencies to say, hey, this is important to the president, so we're serious about working on these things. And those have been successful. All things that are aspirational on the appropriation side, if only we could find the pot of gold or hit the world lottery and whatever. Yeah, we'd love to pour a ton of money into housing issues and housing programs and solve all those problems, but that's just not going to happen and it's not realistic. So we appreciate that. But more importantly than the plan itself was the enthusiasm they brought to the table and their commitment to work with us as they have over the past 3 years to solve some of the problems that are within the administration's ability to solve. They know that Congress has its role and they can't step on that and they don't have the authority to do that. But there's so much that the administration could and can do, and they've been very proactive in focusing on those issues and working with the industry to get some of those things done. And we are very appreciative of that.
Very good. Thanks for those insights, David. It is incredible to see housing at the tips of the administration and many other politicians, both local and federal. David, you just briefly touched on appropriations, and maybe we'll talk just briefly about HUD. Back in, I think, July, both the House and the Senate had some preliminary transportation, housing, and urban development spending bills. The House was about $68 billion. The Senate, I think, was a little over $90 billion. Really haven't seen much of that since July. We talked about September 30th. Where are things? What are you hearing? What are you seeing?
Well, let's be very clear about the numbers first, Don. You were right. The House came in at 68.2. The Senate net number was 70 billion.
Oh, perfect.
They weren't that far apart. They were $1.8 billion apart, which, you know, if you're thinking about vouchers and things, is a lot of money. In the context of the budget, it wasn't that as significant. It was more important like where the money came from and where they were putting it into. We were concerned as soon as the president and the speaker came to their agreement on the debt ceiling, which, as you know, one of the provisions in that said that they would peg the 2024 budget at FY 2023 numbers. And that was concerning to all of us, but it got the debt ceiling done, which was very significant for the country. You had to get the debt ceiling raised. So they went into the appropriations process knowing that they were basically level funding, which, as we all know, level funding in almost all agencies, but especially HUD, is a cut because the cost of rent goes up, the cost of utilities goes up, the cost of maintenance goes up. So the vouchers don't carry as much weight when they're being level funded as opposed to the year before, FY 2023 coming from 22, where we got a significant bump up in the vouchers. And that made a big difference in being able to put more vouchers out there and award them to more people. So it was a slight increase over FY 2023, but in the end, it's almost flat. It's almost level funding in the context. They are still going to have to take some money out of other programs in order to adequately fund project-based, tenant-based vouchers and some of the other programs that are priorities. Home, more than likely, is going to get cut. to some degree, it's possible CDBG. Some programs might get zeroed out when you look. So it's not done yet. In the context of the process, that is more troublesome in the short term. The Senate has passed out of their subcommittees all 12 of their appropriations bills on a bipartisan basis. And Senate Majority Leader Schumer has said that he's ready to start bringing minibuses, meaning little groups of appropriations bills to the Senate floor, maybe as early as this week, maybe next week, to start passing those out of the Senate. So there does not seem to be any roadblock there for the Senate passing all 12 appropriations bills. And I will say this, the Senate came back into session this week. The House doesn't come back into session next week. The House hasn't even passed their appropriations bills out of the House, and they don't have an agreement within the Republican conference on many of them. They're not sure. They tried to pass some of them before they left for the August recess, but they could not get a majority of the Republicans to support the ones they were going to bring to the floor. So they just threw up their hands and left without passing any of them. And that is a concern as they come back next week. And on top of that, the levels that they are passing the bills out, which are not the FY 2023 levels, they're passing them at the FY 2022 levels, which would be a significant cut, is a big problem because they don't know if they're going to have the votes in the House to get them out of the House, let alone conference with the Senate and come to a budget for FY 2024. Now, if you don't mind me going into the weeds to further explain what's actually going on top of this, you have a group of conservative Republicans, the Freedom Caucus, but they're not necessarily all Freedom Caucus folks. They're just conservative Republicans who don't want to pass a budget. They're fine with limited or no government. Let's pass the defense budget, which is the one bill they have passed, although it hasn't been reconciled with the Senate. There are big differences there. But they're not concerned if they pass a budget, and they're honestly not concerned if the government shuts down. They want to shrink the size of government. They have included a number of poison riders in a number of the appropriations bills that they know will not get past the Senate, let alone the White House would never sign the bill. And we know that we are heading potentially for a train wreck. Now, Speaker McCarthy has discussed the idea of passing a short-term CR or continuing resolution. Anybody who pays attention should know what a CR is because it seems like the government has been funded by those, except for one or two occasions for the past 15 years. They can't come to an agreement on a budget, so they pass a continuing resolution getting them all the way to the next fiscal year and will level funding everything and it's a disaster. He has suggested passing a short-term CR in order to continue negotiations past September 30th with the hopes that they will eventually come to an agreement on the budget, ideally by the end of the year. And there's another kicker there, which I'll get to. His conservative members in the Freedom Caucus and elsewhere have come back to him and said, no, we won't even agree on a short-term CR. We're not going to go there unless they add border security money, they include all these riders they want done, and they pass it at FY 2022 levels, which everybody knows the Senate on a bipartisan basis will not go for. So given the fact that when they come back next week, they're going to have 12 legislative days before the end of the fiscal year, and they have not passed one of the 12 appropriations bills out of the House, let alone started negotiating with the Senate, we are warning and counseling folks to prepare for a shutdown of some length of time. It could be a week. It could be 2 weeks. It's as long as Speaker McCarthy believes that he has to let this go before he opens negotiations with the Democrats in the House and the Senate, the bipartisan Senate, on a CR to get them to the end of the year, potentially, so they can continue negotiations. And then there's all these other political issues that come into play, calling the question of the chair, whether or not they're going to challenge his speakership. I question that now because none of us know who they could get other than Kevin McCarthy right now, who could get 218 votes in the House. So he's probably safe there, but they could still try that maneuver. But if he does that, it's risky because then he's saying we're going to pass a budget with Democratic votes, just like we did the debt ceiling, which got him in a lot of trouble. This would be even bigger because these are policy goals of members of his conference. Now, his conference is not unified. There are a lot of his members who want to pass a budget and want to do it in conjunction with the Senate and get this done. They don't believe in this brinkmanship. But he has to let the politics play out. Now, getting to the point about the end of the year, the other little point that they included in the debt ceiling was if they don't pass a budget, not a CR, a budget by the end of the calendar year, then there will be an additional 1% cut to every budget across the board. Every budget is supposed to be funded at FY 2023 levels, except the Pentagon, the defense budget. They got an increase. Bipartisan-wise, people want to support the military. We have foreign operations going. We're funding a war in Ukraine, which is different. It's supplemental. But there was agreement there, and they said, fine, let's take the Pentagon off the table. But everybody else, we're going to cut your budget or level fund it. But this 1% cut at the end of the year, if they don't pass a budget, the Pentagon gets whacked as well. The defense budget gets whacked as well. And that was done to kind of entice Republicans not to go with a CR, to work with Democrats, mainly in the House because the Senate's on board with this, and pass a real honest-to-God budget. Let's have a budget, not a CR. So we're worried about that as well. And we have a long time, although the clock's ticking fast, on December 31st. But that's a concern too, because an additional 1% cut on top of level funding this year, then we're really, I don't know how HUD particularly would be able to handle that without looking at doing something tricky, as three of us know they've done in the past on vouchers, funding for so long and then back funding and things like that. It's going to be hard for them and other agencies to accommodate an additional 1% cut. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a lot considering what they have. So we are watching the next 4 weeks very carefully because, again, I think there will be a shutdown. I hope I'm wrong, but I believe there'll be a shutdown of some time. But I'm hoping they can come to an agreement, a reasonable agreement that will not entail any further cuts to budgets, which will lead to a budget by the end of the year, avoiding that 1% cut. And then we can start moving on and looking at 2024 and then 2025 and then an end of year tax bill. And I'm sorry, that was a lot, but there's a lot going on. So I apologize for being so long-winded.
No, that's a lot. But I get back to what you said earlier. Let's still have some optimism. I'd like to shift gears real quick because I know this is really important to a lot of listeners out there. As we were planning for the discussion, you mentioned insurance, right? It's the single most significant issue outside the AHCIA provisions. So we're seeing this a lot with our clients in both operations, as we're drafting new projections, trying to get them to work, and everybody's really struggling to get coverage. Can you let us know what the industry is actually doing around this insurance discussion?
Sure, Greg, absolutely. And you know, insurance is fascinating because the Housing Advisory Group, we started focusing on this back in 2020. And back then, it was largely a liability issue. It was the beginning of COVID, so we hadn't really hit a lot of the supply chain issues, driving up the cost of materials, construction costs going through the roof, labor issues because of COVID, construction delays, all the things we do to change place and service deadlines. This was before all this really started to hit. And back then, it was a liability issue because we were seeing absolute cases of redlining going on for affordable housing developments based on who they house, not any particular events taking place, or an event could take place 30 miles away and they would raise the rates on a development 30 miles in the opposite direction simply because they both house the same types of tenants or the same income levels. And that was a big problem. So this started off as a liability issue. Then COVID came, but then 2022 happened. And in 2022, you had the hurricane down in Florida. You had the wildfires in California. You had the flooding in California and in other parts of the country. And all of a sudden, then hurricanes and everything in Texas too. A lot of people got affected by different things in the Gulf Coast. And 2022, it changed to a property and casualty issue. Insurance companies started to raise rates. Then they started to leave markets. If they were in a market still, the rates they were charging were unacceptable and unattainable and through the roof. I mean, and fortunately for us, and I say this, if there was a silver lining in this, it's that it affected everybody. It wasn't just affordable housing. It was single family housing. It was market rate multifamily housing. It was commercial building. Everybody was getting whacked. And an issue that we were initially meeting with the administration on and talking very on a focused wise basis with people on the Hill, because we didn't want to blow this up into an insurance tort reform issue with the redlining, it became a national issue. Everybody had the problem and more people started to hear about it. And the more offices then we started to go into and meetings we had in the White House, they were like, oh God, we know. But then we started to show them the data and it was so much worse than what they thought it was. So I will say this, I have rarely seen the industry coalesce and come together as quickly as we have on this particular issue. And it highlights for the policymakers on the Hill, and it has, and in the White House how significant this is. This isn't a resource issue, and this isn't an issue that we need to fix over the next 5 or 10 years. This is an immediate issue. And we have told them flat out that if we don't fix this expeditiously, you are going to see people drop out of the business. You're going to see housing not being built in markets because they cannot get insurance. And we try to explain to them, if we can't get construction insurance and liability insurance and then property and casualty insurance as the construction's completed before we lease up, we can't open a development. We're not allowed to. There are tenants involved in both the federal programs, the state programs, and then with our financiers that would not allow development to move forward if we were not carrying insurance. And so the fact that they're hearing this from the single family folks and how expensive it is, and the market rate multifamily folks, but on the affordable side, how dire it is, they understand the urgency. Thus, this morning, our first hearing on the issue before the Senate Banking Committee, whom we had a meeting with about a month ago at their request to explain the issue to them. And we were very happy to hear a number of our talking points used by members of the Senate Banking Committee, as well as some of the witnesses who were outstanding on behalf of doing something about this crisis. It's out in the public eye now. It's hard to read a newspaper in any municipality or region of the country that isn't talking about insurance. All the major publications, periodicals, magazines have had articles about it, which we can share with everybody that are out there. And it is a dire case. So the industry has coalesced and come together in a number of working groups, but in a single large working group, which is being headed up by the National Multi-Housing Council. Housing Advisory Group's a member, all of our other colleagues on that group are members. National East Housing has taken an active role in this, and they have surveys in the field, getting information from developers and owners on what's going on at street level. So we have the data as an NMHC. And the goal is to get together with the insurance industry to come up with an answer, a solution to what will bring them back into markets and offer insurance at reasonable rates, at premiums that everybody, but mainly, but for us, affordable housing developments can afford. And also at the same time, let's solve this liability issue of you guys targeting affordable housing because of who our tenant base is, unrightly so in most cases. We'll fix that as well. So we don't know when the fix is going to happen, but the fact that the hearing took place this morning and it was as productive as we believe it was, there will be more of those. There'll be more conversations. And as we collect the data from these surveys that are out there, we look forward to working with folks in the insurance industry and elsewhere to try to come up with a solution or solutions we can then take to Congress and the administration to say, no, we don't think that the government should be involved in the insurance market. But in the context of shoring up and giving confidence to the insurance market so that they will continue to provide the product which we all need and at affordable and reasonable rates, yes, we are very much in favor of the government doing that. We think that there can be a productive role without the federal government being too intrusive, and we think it's going to be necessary.
Very good. No, thank you for that update. No, we'll stay on top of that, and obviously super important. Dave, while we have you here, just a couple of other quick items, if you'd be able to touch on a couple of items that have been out there for a while, CRA regulations, as well as GSE tax status. Quick updates maybe on those?
Yeah. So CRA real quick, because there's not a lot to add, but we do believe now that we will be seeing the new CRA regs out sometime in October. We have gotten that word. Can't say from where, but we have gotten the word that it will be sometime in October. We are, the closer it gets, the more nervous and giddy we are going to be because we're very concerned about whether or not they listened to everybody and read their comments on how awful it would be for them to get rid of the investment test and the effect it would have on the affordable housing market, specifically investment in LIHTC. So we are hopeful based on that and conversations we have individually had with the regulators over the past 6 months. I know I've had a number of those with the head of a couple of the federal agencies. They say they understand what we're saying. We're going to find out. So we're expecting those in October sometime. Stay tuned. On the GSE's tax status, which is so irritating, I have to be honest with you. We thought this was taken care of a long time ago when this question was raised in the early 2000s, but then again in 2008 on the financial collapse. But the question as to whether or not Fannie and Freddie are taxable or tax-exempt entities is out there again, and it is adversely affecting investment in affordable housing and the development of affordable housing, specifically in rural areas, because they have had to pull out of all, if not most, of the multi-investor funds in which they invest, and they will not meet their duty to serve goals, which is largely in rural and hard to develop areas. So We have been working with the White House, nudging them to try to get Treasury and the service to once and for all come out with the IRS to come out and say, no, Fannie and Freddie are taxable entities. They always have been, and they continue to be today. A bipartisan letter headed up by Senator Warner, of Virginia, went to Secretary Yellen 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago. We are not sure if they've gotten a response to that, but we continue to nudge. There might be a letter coming out of the House on a bipartisan basis asking the same to nudge them, but we hope to get this resolved soon because at this time in the marketplace, with inflation and everything else going on, supply chain issues, which are largely relieved, but still cost of labor and everything else, we don't need one more thing out there hindering affordable housing production, especially in the areas that need it the most. So, Don, we hope to have that issue resolved soon.
David, thanks for touching on that. And this is all great stuff. And given all of what we discussed so far, we feel success with much needed housing provisions coming from strong advocacy, obviously. What can our listeners do to support this legislation or any other items that we've discussed today?
Well, Garrick, you touched on my favorite part of the gospel, which is the book of advocacy. Nothing we have accomplished since the founding of the program was done because of people like me walking in the door in Washington, D.C. It's all because members of the House and the Senate and administrations have heard from constituents at home and from constituents that both benefit from the housing, are building the housing, get services from the housing, or providing services in the housing. It's a constituent issue. And so I cannot say it enough. If you do one thing and one thing only, other than your job, it's make sure your local electeds, and that's from city council, county commissioner, mayor, your state senators and reps, all the way up to your congressperson and your two senators, let them know what you're doing in their state and their district. Because if you let them know and you get they and or their staff out to see it, we have almost a 100% success rate on getting members on board with LIHTC once they have been to a LIHTC development. So we need folks, if you're not doing it already, to get out there and advocate for the low-income housing tax credit, for the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act. It's not hard to do. All the resources are online. They are on the Housing Advisory Group website. They are on the rentalhousingaction.org website, which is the umbrella advocacy group. There's a great advocacy toolkit there as well as on our website. And it's as easy as sending an email to the district director for your congressperson and saying, hey, we're developing this in your district for veterans, families, seniors, whoever it's for, come take a look. We'd love to talk to you about it and have the congressman or congresswoman crow about it. Give them credit for it. We don't care, just so we can continue to build it. So advocacy is the key. If we want to get more resources for affordable housing, if we want to fix the insurance problem, if we want to fix these regulatory issues that are holding us up from building more affordable housing or making it so cumbersome with paperwork, advocacy is the way to do it. It's the only way things get done. So please pick up your stylus, type on your keyboard, pick up a phone. If you're still talking a phone to people, I know most of us still do. And just say, thank you very much for what you do. Let us show us how we're benefiting your constituents. Come and see. We'll make sure you're happy.
Very good. That's it for this episode of The Buzz House. David, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for everything the Housing Advisory Group and yourself personally do for the industry. That covers it for today. And once again, I'm Don Bernards.
And I'm Garrick Gibson. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at buildabakertilly.com. That's BUILD@BakerTilly.com. See you next time on Buzz House.